We've been looking for those anew at the section in the Rambam where it deals with the 13 categories of things that a person can do which are so bad or so specifically connected to a person's inner life, let's say, that they can destroy one's entire inner being. As we've explained many times before, every word of Torah is critical. It's not that some are negotiable and others aren't. He'll say himself in a while, we'll see in the Rambam, that someone who denies even a word or a letter of Torah actually denies the whole thing. As we've tried to explain before, it's like someone... the thing's an integral whole. It's as if somebody says that he has a radio set, let's say, and there's a little piece of wire missing someplace. Well, it wouldn't do to tell that person that on average the thing's okay. It doesn't work that way. The thing would work if it's tiny, it doesn't matter how small. When they put things into a radio, the people who make those things, they put in things that are essential. They don't waste equipment, components. If you take out even just a millimeter of a gap of wiring someplace, the thing won't work. And Torah is like that also. It's a circuit that's all connected together. That's the description and the source of the spiritual world, which is the genes of the description of the physical world. And therefore, if a piece is missing, the whole thing doesn't operate. But these 13 things, as we've tried to explain before, not that they are any more essential than any other, but these are the, let's say, the main blood vessels that feed the spiritual being, and therefore cutting one of these is directly cutting out the entire spiritual existence. Not that they're more important, but that they're more, let's say, critical or, let's say, life-threatening if a person manages to break one of these. We did try and point out together before that it's not just someone who casually denies, it's somebody who knows what he means. Most Jews of this generation who don't have correct information or education about Torah, when they deny, that's simply an act of lack of information or lack of knowledge. It's not denial in the sense that we're talking about here. But if a person would be able to deny correctly, which means he really knows what he's talking about and then really denies the way that you have to in order to fulfill these criteria, then any one of these 13 would immediately cut a person off from existence in the next world. Which means now. It doesn't only mean when he dies. It means now he'd be cut off from spiritual existence. The Rambam says elsewhere, the Gemara says that this punishment of Kores, which means being excised or excision, being cut off from the next world, actually has practical application. In this world, it means a person does not survive beyond a certain age. And it also can, chas v'shalom, mean childlessness and other aspects to it. Also, a discussion in the Gemara, whether that age is 50 or 60. But it's not good. It's not good. That's what these 13 things are. Now, we saw the first... If you have any questions, you are welcome. Sunday night is when you're supposed to ask questions. If I'm able to, I'll try and answer. If you have questions on the subject, there's time afterwards you can ask on anything if I'm able to answer. But meantime, if you have questions on the subject, I'm happy to try. Something maybe that wasn't clear till now or from last week. Okay, so we saw the categories that the Rambam lists. The 13 categories, and I'd like to point out, I don't know how long ago we mentioned it, that these 13 things, if you want to see the positive phrasing of these 13, then you'll find it in a number of places. In his commentary on the Gemara, the Rambam, here he brings the negative phrasing because this is a book of law. This is halacha, which means this is what you have to do. If you fail to do one of these, it's the most direct injury to the spiritual world. Therefore, he lists them here as halachic obligations. People who deny this, deny this, deny that. But when he comments on the Gemara, where he gives you the philosophical insight, he there phrases it in the positive. And he says that these are the 13 things that are fundamentals of Jewish belief. As we tried to illustrate a number of times, it's not that they're any more fundamental than anything else, as I've tried to explain, but these are 13 things that are, let's say, critical. And he phrases and explains all 13 of them. You'll find them phrased in many other places. In the Siddur, you'll find, in almost every Siddur that I've ever seen, after the morning davening, after Shacharis, they have their phrase 13, what they call articles of faith, I think they call it. Ani ma'amin b'emunah shlema, I believe with a perfect faith, in this, in this, in this, and so forth. That same phrasing is used. According to many authorities, the Rambam probably didn't write that. He probably didn't phrase that particular wording, which is so famous and so well known among Jews. But it certainly follows exactly, very exactly, somebody of tremendous greatness wrote that following the formula that he lays down here. There's another famous place where you'll find these 13, and that is in Yigdal. I don't know what you're bothering to do at this shirim. Take a break next week, maybe, and you could in Yigdal, the famous song that people, many people say Shachris every morning, some shul say every Friday night, Yigdal has actually got 13 lines, and if you read it carefully you'll see it's a beautiful poem, each line of which actually brings out in a beautiful, very deep way, brings out one of these 13 things. So that's the first thing to realize, is that these aren't 13 articles of faith. You don't subscribe to sort of a manifesto in Torah. It doesn't work that way. Other things are sort of peripheral and these are central. It isn't like that. There is an opinion that it does work that way. But that's not the Rambam's opinion. We're studying his for the meantime. And therefore, these are 13 things that are critical areas in the spiritual world. Now, the first area we saw together was, we're revising very briefly, the five subcategories of people who are called deniers. I don't know what you call them in English, as we said before, atheists, people who actively deny a transcendent existence. Then we said that there were five subcategories, as you remember we discussed. The second grouping is what the Rambam says, that there are three subcategories in this group, and that is people who are apikosin, again, some sort of denier. But it becomes clearer when you look at the specifics. The first is, and this is what we started seeing last week, let's see it again, that there's no such thing as prophecy. Right? What does he mean? There is no such thing as a wisdom or a connection, let's say. Mada means, it's a noun that comes from das, which means inner knowledge. That means there's no power that powers the inner knowledge of a man, let's say, or a woman, that comes from Hashem. Okay? That means that you live here, you may have spiritual power, you may believe in all the other things. That means you may believe that there's a creator of the world, that he's one, that there aren't two of them, that he has no body, he's a completely infinite being, and so forth and so on. But you just don't believe that he speaks to human beings. If that's the case, if you disconnect the world of transcendence from the world of the practical that we experience, then you don't have a share in that transcendent world. We tried to explain once before that these are not arbitrary, but these are because if you don't believe in a certain thing, and again, we had so many problems here to try and translate into English where the concepts are all wrong. Belief isn't the word either, it means knowledge. In Judaism, you aren't required to believe something. You can't. You can't stand up and say you believe something that you don't actually believe. It's just nonsense that. What we're working on here is achieving knowledge of these things. That's not... Are you with me? It doesn't mean you have to wake up and sort of pronounce that you believe it. It's just not sincere. It can't be. Belief is something that's a very, very intense personal thing. What we really mean is knowledge of these things. And the way a person gets knowledge is by studying the subject and experiencing it according to the guidelines that are laid down, which you haven't seen. In this regard, the Rambam lists that in another section that we haven't studied together. The person works on these things to the point that he has inner knowledge of these things. That's the requirement. Somebody asked the question a few weeks ago, which is important to know, before a person has such knowledge. I'm just saying this question now because I know you're all about to ask it. Just saving you the trouble. Until a person has this inner knowledge, so is he liable for these terrible punishments? What happens to me right now? I don't know these 13 things. I can't honestly say that I know them intimately. So am I liable to this terrible punishment? That was what you were about to ask, right?
Yeah.
Right. And therefore, the answer is as follows. No, you're not liable for this punishment, but it means that the Rambam says clearly, right, it should have been clear from what we discussed already, that to be liable for this terrible non-existence in the spiritual world, you have to know what you're talking about and actively deny it with all your being. That means you have to knock it out of existence. But if you simply haven't reached the level yet where you've had the chance to access that knowledge, you haven't worked on it yet, you haven't reached that level of spiritual sensitivity, then you're not yet considered to be in that level. Along with many other subcategories of this problem, as we discussed before, people who simply didn't have the opportunity to find out, or people who even actively deny but out of a lack of knowledge or misguided background where they never really experienced it and so forth, or somebody who has certain personality problems, let's say, various categories of people. The Rambam clearly makes it clear elsewhere that those do not come in for this particular category. I mentioned once before, it's an argument among the Rishonim how liable you are if you could have had the knowledge and didn't choose to get it. Yes, please.
Based on that knowledge, if you're going to reject it, one could ask if the argument is imperfect knowledge in the first place, ergo, it's
a good question. I understand the question. Yes. The question, for those who didn't hear, was how can you ever do anything wrong in this area? Because if you really have the spiritual knowledge and you know it to be true, you couldn't possibly choose wrong. Is that right? if you know the truth about the world and you have access to it and you're in touch with it and you see that things work that way, right, you have to be insane to choose wrongly. And on the other hand, if you don't know properly, correctly, you don't have the real inner knowledge, as we're saying here, you're not liable. So there's a number of levels that this question has to be answered on. But I think one that might cover them all is as follows. I hope this is enough, this answer. It may not be, but it goes a long way. And that is this, that if you think about it for a minute, you'll see that a human being has a unique construction. And that is that he has there's an incredible faculty in the human mind to divorce true knowledge and application of that knowledge. A person can know a thing absolutely, intimately and thoroughly, know exactly what it means and what it's doing to him, and despite that, do it anyway. That's a unique feature of a human being, that there's a gap between what the Torah calls the head and the heart. It says, V'yadata hayom, you have to know today, V'hashevoisa elavavecho. There's two different mitzvahs. You first have to know this, and then you have to force it down into your heart. You have to sit it upon the heart, it says. Which means that you can know it intellectually, and you can really know it. Don't fool yourself or have some vague idea. You can know it absolutely intimately at a level of prophetic knowledge, and you can fail to force it into the personality in such a way that you can act in complete discord with this thing. And there are many, many illustrations of it. The classic is the one of Detlef always used to give. Are you with me so far? It seems miraculous. It seems totally bizarre that a person should function that way, but you'll see that people always function that way. About Detlef, in fact, which means, of course, the outcome of this is that the work of Yiddishkeit of Torah is not just to know things. That's the easy part. To achieve supernatural knowledge, transcendent knowledge, if a person's exposed correctly, if a person would sit in yeshiva the way he should, right, and study what he should, and be with people of greatness where you see manifest transcendent phenomena, you see people on a different level, you couldn't possibly confuse them for gorillas. Not as this generation tries to teach you that people are. I couldn't possibly do that. But the problem is that after you have that knowledge, do you walk out the next day and behave on a saintly level, or do you still give in to your lower self? It is a tremendous schizoid split between the knowledge and the action, but that's what a human being is. Right? The anatomy of that problem is Musa. The study of Musa means the problem of the gap between the mind and the heart and how to close that gap. Now, Dessler always used to give the fantastic example. I can tell you from my experience as a doctor, and we've seen this so many times, a person who smokes, knowing what it's doing to them, knowing clearly what it's doing. I've seen doctors who smoke. People who suffer from illness from the smoking, and then what happens is that comes time for another cigarette, and they say, what is one more cigarette going to do to me? So they say. You follow? Look, I know what this is doing overall, but you know, one more cigarette is completely insignificant in the grand scheme of things. So they have that one more cigarette. So then a few hours later, they say, what is one more cigarette going to do? And they say, I had a patient when I was an intern in the hospital who had lost a leg. He had Burgess disease. Burgess disease is a disease that's directly related to smoking. Some people are so sensitive to it, they have a very acute vascular problem, and the vessels close down and they lose limbs. The man had lost, when I first met him, he'd lost a leg, and he was still smoking. He was still smoking. And he knew exactly what it was doing, and he hated himself for it, and he just couldn't bear to, after he'd had a cigarette, he was clear that he never would do it again. Okay? But he just wasn't able to do it. The last time I saw him was being wheeled down the hospital corridor without any legs. That he'd lost the second leg and he was still smoking. But knowing exactly that this was happening, he was told about it beforehand, it was clearly diagnosed, he knew exactly, an intelligent man. What can you say? Now, Dessler himself gave up smoking. He used this as an example, one of the great Balmers, and he gave up smoking also. There's a subtle anatomy behind it, which is a fantastic subject. I'm not going to go into it in too much detail, but I'll just tell you two applications of it. Are you with me so far? It goes a long way to answering the question, right? I mean, yeah. Not argument, that's a fact.
Okay.
I'm glad if you're not in touch with it, but unfortunately I have one.
No. But then if you use the Zahora, isn't it true that I'm not using an excuse, you could say that Hashem,
In fact, you're right about that. Let's cover that first. You hear what the question was? The question was, since Hashem created you with this negative drive and this inability to connect the two in a natural way, and this tremendous drive that drives you towards the lower self and towards the satisfaction of the body and so forth, so when you get upstairs in the next world, you'll have an excuse. You'll be able to say, Hashem, you gave me this drive and I did the best I could. So that's clearly right. All the mystical sources and the Muslim sources say that if you did Averis, you have to hear this well, when you transgressed, you did things that were wrong, that you were driven to because of the drive of bodily pleasure, you will have a tremendous excuse. That's what it says. You will have a tremendous excuse. You will have a leg to stand on, right? When you say that, Hashem, I had difficulty in this area because you gave me a powerful drive. And of course, if you had a particular problem, that you had a particular difficulty or drive in a certain area, you will have proportionately greater an excuse in that area. However, sins that you did that didn't give any pleasure, you'll have no excuse for at all. For example, it says speaking badly about people, Lashon Hara. Generally, we have to understand in much more detail. We did discuss it last week or 2 weeks ago, but to some extent, but it is one of the problems that you'll have much less excuse for because you benefit much less directly. If you steal from someone, you can say that I was poor and I was starving and so forth and I needed it and this and that and the other. But if you spoke badly and ruined someone's reputation in the world and prevented a marriage that they were about to contract or getting a job or something, you gain nothing from that, so you'd have much less of an excuse. However, of course, what it boils down to is, if you can say to Hashem, you gave me this drive and I did the best I could. If you really say you did the best you could and you really did the best you could, you're fine. He doesn't expect more than the best you could. The problem is, that's right, the problem is that it isn't usually the best that you could. In fact, and that is such an immense statement that, as I've mentioned to you before, the Chazal say that when a person faces Hashem in the next world, when he faces up to the spiritual world, it says they take all your negativity and they take the whole Yetzer, that means your own, all your drive to loneliness, all your drive to the material, to the physical, to all negativity, and they show it to you for what it is. They actually show it to you. They expose it, they tear it out of your neshama, and they show it to you. And it says this, that great tzaddikim, people who succeeded in conquering their Yetzer, they are shown an enormous mountain, an insurmountable mountain, that was their own negative urge. And they say to Hashem, how did I ever manage to overcome that? And Rishoyim, that is people who bowed to the temptation of their lower selves and never coped with it, they are shown something a hair's breadth thin. And they say, how was it I wasn't able to overcome that? That's what happened. So you have to know that, yes, if you haven't surmounted the mountain, so there's only a hair's breadth between you and that. But these are things that only you can know in your own neshama. If you really can sit here and say, I don't mean you, if one can really sit here and say, Hashem, listen, you're giving me this problem and I'm really doing the best I can, you need to see someone from the other profession first before, you know, that's just not honest. You know? You have to be on a tremendous madraga, and the people who really honor madraga are the first ones to face up to the fact that they're hardly doing what they could be doing. You know? That's the problem. But you're right. In as much as you do have a difficulty in that area, of course it's judged in relation to that. I wanted to give you two examples. The one is, well, let's look at this. We mentioned this before some time ago. It's incredible. I've heard this used, although it wasn't said in this way. I've heard it cited by a man of one of the greatest people of this generation as a proof for the existence of a spiritual world. And to him, this idea is so clear that it actually proves for him, right, as if he needs proof, but anyway, that if you want to point to a technical point that proves that there must be a transcendent dimension, actually this is it. That wasn't why it was said, but it comes out of it. And the example which shows you clearly this gap between idea and action is as follows. See if we can try and understand it together. Very subtle thing, not easy to see. If you heard it, I don't remember who was here when we last discussed it or when we last discussed it, but if you did hear it before, it takes more than one time to go through this idea to really understand it, but let's try anyway. He said the following thing. Yisrael Salanta, right, in Or Yisrael, in fact, Yisrael Petterberger, who wrote the famous commentary on it, they bring out the following idea. You can look it up yourself and see. Bring out the following idea. If you want to see the gap between ideal knowledge and between the way you function, that means between the way you actually use the knowledge, between what the knowledge is in its abstract sense in the mind, and between how you relate, never mind actually act in the world, but how you relate to the knowledge, then you have an incredible example, which is this. And that is the fear of Hashem. That means fearing God, fearing Hashem, fearing sin. You have the thing called Yiras Hashem, Yiras Chet, Yiras Hashem, Yiras Shamayim, as we've discussed before. The problem with it, he explains, is as follows. Fearing Hashem means, in its crudest sense, I mean in its most practical, you know, sense, is a person having the fear that when he does something wrong, he may be punished for this. And that's a fantastic level. Halavai, we should function on that level. Of course, it's not what we're striving for. What we're striving for is a level of love, that you do a thing because it's right and because Hashem wants it, and regardless of the reward or punishment, as we discussed together. But before you get to that level, you get to a level of fear, and even when you do get to that level, you always retain the level of fear. Simple, straightforward fear, abject terror. Rabbi Shlomo himself used to walk around, people of his generation. There were many in his generation whom I've met, people who met them, who say that the day before Yom Kippur they used to walk around shaking. That means they used to walk around trembling and sweating. Now you can't fake that. Rabbi Shlomo himself one year got up to speak about Yom Kippur, and he got up on the bima in Vilna and he said the words Yom Kippur and he fainted. The kid had to wait till he came round. I mean, it was an abject terror. A man had reached close to perfection. One of the greatest men of his generation, if not the greatest. And he couldn't stand the idea of Yom Kippur without passing out. Okay? You have to know what fear of sin means. I mean, we don't see it anymore in this generation. We don't see it. But in that generation, you had people who got to a level where it was so tangible to them. It says clearly, Rabbi Saul, it's well known, he once went to Odessa. He once traveled to a town in Russia, Odessa. And in Odessa, he walked out on Shabbos and he saw a Jew smoking. He saw a Jew smoking on Shabbos and he passed out. The shock of seeing someone being Mechal Shabbos openly was so great, so intense, that he lost consciousness. The next Shabbos, he saw it again and he didn't faint. And he said, it's time to leave town. And he left. He left town. So he was so desensitized. I've seen a thing once. You follow? Seeing a thing once. The second time I've seen it. I'm so desensitized already that it doesn't, somebody breaking Hashem's will so openly doesn't leave, doesn't hit me like it did before. He left town because of the lack of sensitivity that was suffering. But I mean, yeah, the concept of a man who brings himself to a level of fear. So the problem that he writes is this. Fear of Hashem means the abject terror of what the punishment may be for doing things that are wrong. That's a straightforward, simple, childlike fear. It means you're going to get punished. It may be a horrendous punishment. In fact, anybody knows anything about, I won't be accused again of making people miserable, but if you know anything of what's written about the punishments in the next world, I can't bring myself even to tell you any of the explicit descriptions of what it is that happens. Of course, the descriptions are only Mishalim, they're only metaphors, because there isn't a body. The descriptions are always of bodily suffering. I'll tell you one simple one. It says that... No, I'm telling you the simplest one that shouldn't frighten you at all compared to the others. It says that there's a fire over there, and the fire is 60 times hotter than fire here. That's what it says. And one of the great Kedonim of the last generation used to every day pass his finger through a candle, to burn his finger in a candle flame, just to personally get the message tangibly of what fire really means when it burns you. And then he used to remind himself that it's 60 times hotter over there. Right? That's what he used to do. Now, that is nothing, I assure you, compared to, that's child's play, compared to many of the descriptions of what goes on as a consequence for people who... No. So now the problem is this. That should generate a lot of fear. Right? A lot of fear. It should generate abject terror. So the question he asks over there is, how come we're not afraid? That's what he asks. How come we're not afraid? Now, if you analyze the question, you'll see like this. Stay with me now, because it's a fantastic idea. If you've got half an ear, but anything, any sensitivity in you at all, this is a question that has to be grappled with, one of the most difficult questions that you could ever come across. And the question is this. This possibility of suffering in the next world, of punishment, right? Of imminent punishment, and going to a world where you'll be punished and suffer terribly, this possibility is a possibility. But nobody's right mind can deny that it's a possibility. You follow? You might say, well, I'm an atheist, I don't believe in this kind of thing, but like it's possible. You might have decided in your mind that you've weighed up the possibilities, and for whatever reasons and philosophical ideas you have in your head, you've decided that it's not worth believing in, or that it's unlikely, or whatever logic you have in your head, but it's possible. Anybody who tells you that it's not possible is either a liar or a fool. Somebody who can pretend to know what goes on in the next world, right, who really knows for sure that it doesn't exist and there's no suffering, person's lying or an idiot. Right? Nobody can know that it doesn't exist. You might argue that I can't know that it does. Fine, I'm prepared to accept that. But that he can know that it doesn't, of course he can't. Are you with me? Which means that anybody in his right mind, no matter what his attitude to life is, has to admit that it's possible. That you have to agree with that. Huh? It's clear. It's possible. What's the percentage probability? What's the probability? Of course, you can't put a figure on that. How can you say that? You can make up in your own mind, I think it's a 1% probability, or 10%, or 50%, whatever you want to say. Right? But 1%, would you agree? 5%, 2%, 1%. It's a distinct possibility, right? There are a lot of reliable people who talk about this, a fantastic body of wisdom with very impressive people backing it up for thousands of years who talk this way. Well, it's the most consistent body of human wisdom that there's ever been. And it talks explicitly about these things. I mean, it must make you think for a second that this thing may be possible. So he says the following thing. So if it's possible, and it's the most awful pain that there could ever be, and it lasts for an awfully long time, how come we aren't terrified? Now, let's think a bit further. You may say, well, I'm not terrified because it's only a possibility. I'm only terrified by things that are definite. I'm not afraid of possibilities. You follow? When you show me an awesome, fearsome dog that's about to tear me to shreds, right? I'm afraid when I see the dog, because it's a definite thing. But when it's only a possibility, I'm not afraid, but you see, that's nonsense. On the contrary, people are more afraid of something that's a possibility than something that they see for sure. On the contrary, when you see the thing that frightens you, it's often a big relief. When you know what it is you're dealing with that makes you afraid, often it's a big relief. It's before you see the thing, right, when you imagine what it is, that the fear is much greater. And add to that the fact that if you don't know what the thing is that they're frightening you with, it assumes enormous proportions in your mind. That is the way the natural mind works. Are you with me? Imagine, you have to make this graphic. Rabbi Saul himself, the whole structure of his Musa was to take all these spiritual ideas and make them graphic so you could actually feel them. That's why great people like this used to put their finger in the fire. They weren't playing games. They wanted to make it graphic because the point is the head can understand, but the heart doesn't want to understand. So they teach the heart to understand by actually working through the lower side. So they used to say things like, for example, imagine, it's obvious, let's say you're standing outside a room, okay, you come home, and they tell you that in a certain room in the house is a lethal danger. Correct? But they're not actually sure about it. Okay, it may be. They saw this poisonous cobra, right, fly through the house, and somebody thinks it might have gone into that room. Actually, they're pretty sure that it actually went out. But it might have just gone into that room and they've got the door closed. Now, you have to go into that room and look under the beds and flush this thing out, okay? That's only a possibility. You follow? No, it's not there for sure, by no means. In fact, there's a 99% chance that it actually went out. They're pretty sure they saw it leave. Okay? How did you walk into that room? Well, I'm not afraid of possibilities. March in? That's not the way it goes. If you go in at all, and if you don't die of fright before you enter the room, you go in only with the most elaborate, is that right? Most elaborate precautions. Is that right? Armed to the teeth. Right? Sheeted in metal. I mean, how would you go in there? And hot pound? I mean, terrified. So you are. Just, what does it? Let's add to that a couple of details. What happens if you don't know what it is that's in there? Does it make it any better? It makes it a heck of a lot worse. If you don't know what it is that right? Imagine, add to that the percentages. What percentage probability does it have to be before you stop being afraid? Or ask yourself honestly. 50-50? Let's think about it logically. Let's do an experiment. Let's say you're standing in front of two doors. Okay, there's some awful nightmare, okay? They take a hold of you and they put you in a little chamber, and the chamber has two doors and you have to go through one of them. One of them is bliss forevermore. No problem. In the other one is the most gruesome, hideous, painful, horrific torment. You don't actually know what it is. But the people who even talk about it go cold with fear. When they try to tell you what it is and they can't find the words. Now, you're free to choose either door. Okay? That's 50-50. You got to think, but no one would walk through the door. Now, let's ask ourselves, how many probabilities or possibilities do you have there? Let's say there are 100 doors in front of you. 100 doors. You're standing in front of a place, there's 100 doors. 99 of them, okay, have got absolute bliss behind them. No problems at all. Security, bliss, happiness, no problem. One of them has an awful terror. I mean, if you think about it seriously, even a cockroach in a room is enough for some people to induce abject terror. It doesn't have to be a lethal cobra. A cockroach is enough. A miserable mouse, okay, is enough to drive some people insane with terror. But certainly when it starts to reach the proportions of something that might actually hurt you. So you've got 100 doors in front of you. I mean, you have to make it graphic. What can I do? One of these contains the most hideous, awful danger. And you're free to walk through all of them. Right? What's your response? Even if you do walk through, if they're going to pay you a fortune, you'll be a millionaire for the rest of your life. Total financial security forever. Okay? If you hit one of the 99. Of course, if you hit the other one, well, they give the money to somebody else. They won't do that. How do you walk through one of those doors? Right? If you're a sensitive individual, normal human being, probably you wouldn't do it. probably you wouldn't do it. And if you do it, you would be in utter abject terror and trepidation. There's no question. One in a thousand? Let's be honest. How many doors do you need, huh? How many doors do you need in front of you before you actually walk there without any problem at all? Great many. If there's any number, I don't know. If there's any number at all, it's a great many. So let's bring it down to brass tacks. One in a hundred certainly is a great terror. Now. So what have we said? We said the following thing. I mean, there's so many of these. You have to go visit someone, right? You have to go visit someone. You've got to walk from the garden gate to the front door. Okay? You know that someone in that neighborhood has a dog that everybody's walked up that garden path that's been ripped to shreds. It's made the headlines. Okay? There's 10,000 houses in the neighborhood. Right? And there's no reason at all that this has to be the house. And all you have to do is walk 10 meters from the front gate to the door. Would you do it? Probably not. And if you do, right? Anybody sees you, probably think you've gone crazy. I mean, that's how we function. When it's unknown, it's just a possibility, and no matter how slight the possibility, that's the normal. Don't ask me if it's logical or not. That is the normal human response. Now, the people who have these responses, people who function that way, walk around totally in absolute secure happiness about the next world. Doesn't bother them at all. That's not logical. That's not logical. One second. It's possible, right? Let's just think about it for a second. It's possible, right? It's a heck of a lot worse than the worst dog in the neighborhood. That's a great deal worse. It's a great deal worse than a dog that made the headlines a couple of times, I can assure you. Much worse than that. And it goes on and on and on and on. And every detail of it is 60 times worse than that. And you feel it much worse. It doesn't mercifully end soon. You follow? And it's got shame and embarrassment and pain and all kinds of horrendous. Now you said it's possible. You follow how we think? You said it's possible, right? And in your clear moments, you rationalize that it's possible. What percentage chance is it that this next world exists? 10% chance? I'll grant you 1%. 1% chance? And it's awful, right? How come you aren't afraid? So why don't you think that way when you enter the person's house with the dog? You know, why don't you think that it wouldn't happen to me? So why don't we think that this other thing's going to happen to us? They ignore it. So now let's unlobotomize ourselves, okay? Let's think about it logically right now. Let's think about it tonight for the first time. You're right, we've been trained, we've been misguided. They've hammered us since childhood that we're actually just advanced gorillas. And when you finish, it's a little pile of dust and it's all fine. That's what they've told us. But we're sensitive people here this evening, right? We're thinking for ourselves. And we think to ourselves, is this thing possible or isn't it? Well, it's definitely possible. No way out of it, unfortunately. I'd like to say it isn't. But it actually is possible, right? And it's terrible. Terrible. Right? Now, why aren't I afraid? When I'm about to do something wrong, when a person's about to break Shabbos, or do something that he shouldn't do, that says explicitly in the Torah, why is he not terrified? We push it away. Isn't that miraculous? Isn't that miraculous? I invite you to think about it for the next few weeks, eh? Beautiful comment. That's a beautiful comment. That's what Rabbi Shaul says. Let me explain that more fully. That's beautiful. He says this. Listen carefully. I don't know if you understand yourself the depth of what you're saying. Listen to this. You probably do. You probably do. I give you the credit. But I'll tell you the way he puts it. He puts it like this. The point of being here is to be free to choose this path or that path. Right, that's clear, we've discussed it many times, and if you're not satisfied with that idea, the Rambam will explain it in great detail, the concept of free will, free choice. To be free, you have to see two possibilities as real. Right? If you see only one possibility as real, let's say Hashem would have created you in such a way that this fear of heaven would be such a real thing in front of your eyes that you perceive it exactly as real as this fearsome bulldog that's going to tear you apart. Right? So then you wouldn't be free to do wrong. You'd love to do wrong, but you'd be too terrified. Correct? I mean, let's say every time you're about to break Shabbos, as you're about to do it, you actually see the torment. You actually experience, see a fearsome animal about to rip you apart. You actually experience it in your bones, so you definitely couldn't do it. So you'd never be free to do wrong. And the Rambam says that even the slightest avera, even the slightest transgression, is a willful disobedience of the wishes of the king. Doesn't mean how bad the thing is. It might be something that you don't even understand why the thing's bad, but you're disobeying in the face of the king what he wants you not to do, right? And therefore, even the slightest avera is a tremendous slap in the face. And therefore, even the slightest avera, if you saw the consequences, you wouldn't be free to. Therefore, now listen carefully. He says this. Therefore, Hashem doesn't let you see. He takes away from you this awareness of it. Now, you might say, well, but all Hashem has to do is just make it possible, but not certain. You follow? Let's say Hashem will just make it possible. Instead of making it obvious to you that it is certain that you will undergo this torment, all he has to do is just make it possible that you'll undergo it. So the Rebbe Yisrael says clearly like this, but the normal human response to a possibility is just as bad or worse than a certainty. So it wouldn't help. Do you follow? Let's make it clear. Let's say every time you're about to do a sin, every time, this is for the logical minded, right? Let's assume every time you're about to do an avera, you see in front of you clearly the possibility that you'll be torn apart, not the certainty. But you still wouldn't be able to do it. Because the natural human response of fear is that you are terrified, even if the thing's just a 1 in 100 possibility. You've got 100 doors in front of you. And therefore, Hashem couldn't even do that. You follow? You still wouldn't be free to choose, even if he makes it only possible. And therefore, listen to this. It's incredible. He says this, that Hashem creates a human being in the world, and he takes out of his mind a natural peace. That means you have in your mind a natural response of fear. You have fear. Even for a vague and distant possibility, you have awesome fear. Why? To teach you what it means. But when it comes to the fear of the next world and Hashem's punishment and so forth, he miraculously, beyond all reason and all logic, he just lifts it out of your mind so that you're free. It's exactly what you said. Otherwise, you wouldn't be free. But anybody who doesn't recognize that it's miraculous and unnatural doesn't understand life. That's what he says. I'm not telling you my ideas. That's what he says. And I heard a great man say that if there's any proof that you are constructed in a miraculous, supernatural fashion, this is it. Because it doesn't begin to make sense. You follow me? And we're talking about people who are very high level. We're talking about people who really work on themselves, understand Torah. And they really understand what it means in the next world. They really understand it, studied it for years and years and years. You won't see them terrified. You have to be a unique individual, and it's arguable that in this generation we have no more. We have no more people on that level who feel it so much in the flesh that they actually faint with fear when they think about doing something wrong or the punishment that might happen on Yom Kippur. We don't have that anymore. There were generations who knew how to do it. There were generations who knew how to do it. And how you do it is another story. But for us, it's all, if not impossible, close to impossible. You hear what's going on? If you think about it, I'm not sure you're convinced, and I'm not sure you have to be, but if you think about it, it's the opinion of a very great man, one of the greatest Balei Musa who ever lived, right? I mean, certainly in the last generation. His presentation of the subject is that this is a proof that you are constructed illogically, and obviously so, in order to retain your free will in this area. It's a most fantastic idea, yeah. Okay, let's stop right. I knew you were going to say that. Stop right there. Okay. I said in the beginning that I was risking making people upset and miserable and so forth. So. Olam Haba is also the greatest ecstasy that there could be. We'll have to spend a few shirim talking about it. Okay? First of all, again, just for those who have a natural tendency to terror, despite this evening's discussion, we have to say that first of all this only goes on the lines that you couldn't be more fair, first of all. This is not thrown at anybody in any way that's unfair at all. That means, you follow, every possible defense that you could have is given, every possible chance to retract is given, you follow. There's nothing thrown at you that's it's not a fragile system like in the human sphere where they don't exactly understand or they can't maneuver, manipulate. In the spiritual world, it's only exactly what you generated. There's nothing unfair about it that you get slammed for things that you'll be surprised about. No one will be surprised at what will happen to them. Do you follow? If a person really didn't understand the depth of mitzvahs or Torah, so that it won't be held against him. Of course, what will be held against that person is what he did understand, even if it wasn't a Torah value. But you live by that. So you'll be held very accountable for that, and you won't have an answer. It says quite clearly that the punishment that a person experiences in the next world is only what he brings on himself. That means, you follow? In fact, if you want to know, it says that they don't even accuse you. All they do is let you talk. All they do is let you talk. They just show you your life. And when you see the problems, you start saying, but. And the more you say but, the worse you make it. You follow me? I've given you examples before. It says, they say to a person, why didn't you do this and this and this mitzvah? So the person says, well, Hashem, you know, I'm a lazy individual. Look, you made me that way. You know, I'm a very slow-moving, phlegmatic, and I've got no energy for anything, and like, I always was that way. Is that so, they say? And they slide the scene past where you chase women, or you went on some business trip or something, or you had to make a lot of money, something urgent or something like that, and you had frenetic activity for weeks on end without sleeping and eating, and say, well, what's going on? You know, that's tough to get out of that one, you follow. But they didn't do it to you, you did it to yourself. You follow me? So first of all, it's fair. And second of all, the reward and the happiness, first of all, far outweighs this dimension. Far outweighs. It says that bad things happen to 4 generations, but good to 1,000 generations in that proportion. I'm trying to make you feel a bit better. Huh? It says that after the suffering's over, which only lasts for a finite time, whatever that means in that dimension, then a person is corrected and they only enjoy the happiness. Furthermore, it says that a person enjoys and appreciates the suffering because it fixes them up. It's like a difficult medical procedure that has to be done that fixes you up and you need it. Afterwards, you're happy you had that thing because that's what brought you to where you are now. Exactly, the mystics say, like a woman giving birth. The pains are not pleasant while she experiences them, but afterwards she relishes the experience because it brought the child into the world. She's not just happy that it's over, she actually relishes having gone through the experience and it makes the whole thing meaningful. You follow, etc., etc. No, that's only the messianic phase, and we'll all be part of those neshamas. Don't worry about that. Absolutely, and even those who don't, even if it's true that some neshamas will not go into that world, that's only the messianic phase. But it says quite clearly that in the post-messianic age, where there's no physical body left at all, every single Jewish neshama is there. In fact, non-Jewish neshamas also. 600,000 people will only be resurrected in a messianic 1,000 years. That's a specific idea.
But then what about the 6 million Jews that died on the Holocaust? Surely they should
be worthy. Who says they aren't? 6 million? We try to explain that many Jewish neshamas are fragments of the same neshama and will come back united as that neshama. In fact, it says in mystical sources that in the end everyone will reconstitute just one person, Adam or Isha, who was man and woman in one. And you won't feel any lack. It will be a perfect part of that whole. It will be perfection. Don't worry. That's an excellent question, and I would ask, if you don't mind, leaving it till the Rambam deals with it. I can't possibly deal with it on one leg, on one foot, 1 minute. The Rambam has got a whole chapter devoted to the fact of how there could be free will in the first place. How it can be meaningful if Hashem knows beforehand what you're going to do. There's a massive argument in the Rishonim, the most fantastic subject, and you're right, you can't understand. Nobody can. But we'll see it. Okay, we'll see the discussion. Can't possibly do it now. Yeah. I hope so. The last question took 55 minutes. How do you do this?
No, what is the title? Where did you get it? I mean,
what we're discussing this evening?
Yes, the whole book.
This book here?
Yes.
This is the famous Mishneh Torah, Yad HaChazaka of the Rambam. This is just one volume, okay, in which he goes through every single halakha of the Torah. I'm not going to go into detail now about this because not directly our subject, but just as a reference so you can pick it up. The Rambam's monumental work, he wrote many other things also, philosophical, halakhic, many other things. No one in fact knows where he found the time in a lifetime to do it. Maybe figure out the days and weeks that he had. No one. He wrote a parish on the Mishnah. All 6,000 Mishnahs, a detailed commentary on the Mishnah from beginning to end when he was 18. And he wrote it on a ship at sea without any books at all, without any Mishnahs or anything. Just by heart, when he was 18, he wrote a parish that's used today, parish on Mishnahs. It's not as authoritative as this, but it's monumental. It was just when he was 18. No one understands how he managed even this work. But the point is, this is an encyclopedic codification of all Torah law, covering every single Torah source, Chumash, Nach, Midrash, Mishnah, Sifri, Sifro, all the Gemara Yerushalmi, Bavli Yerushalmi, there's not a single source that's left out, and it codifies every single law in the Torah. Not a single detail of all Torah law is left out. Not only that, it was the first codification. No one ever... No, the Shulchan Aruch is modeled on this Rambam. This predates the Shulchan Aruch by 400 years. The Shulchan Aruch is almost a word-for-word copy. And all Sfaradim follow that. The Rambam was a Sfaradim. Follows this particular codification. It's called the Mishneh Torah for the Yad HaChazaka, both of those. This particular section has been reprinted in English. The section that we're learning through now, which is a book called Hilchas Tshuva, has been printed as a book. There's a set of, I think it's printed by CIS on Mos Naim, I don't remember. You'll see it in the Kolel, and I'm sure the bookshop has copies. What they've done is they've taken all the philosophical sections of the Rambam, and many others too, and they've published each chapter as a whole book in English, with a straightforward commentary underneath. And Hilchas Tshuva has a whole book devoted to it, in which you go through all these ideas, free will, reward and punishment, this world, the next, basic structure of the Neshama, and that's how we chose this section to study. So if you want, you can get, even in English, you won't even get a faint hint of the depth of it in English, but you'll get some idea of the purview of seeing that you can look this up in English. Reincarnation. So it says this, again, we also don't understand all these details. But it says the following idea. Also, the Machlokes Rishonim, a discussion with the early authorities about exactly the form that this Gilgul or reincarnation takes. But the basic understanding we have is this, and not easy to grasp either, is this, that when we talk about, it's impossible to cover adequately now, but I'll give you a simple structure to understand it, okay? There's much, much more than this, and there are different opinions, but just a simple structure is this. During which the resurrection will occur, I'm not going to go into the details. We did discuss it in great detail, I think, a week ago, or Monday night, 2 weeks ago. There will be 1,000 years of messianic phase which will be physical. Very physical. It even says there'll be poor people. What that means, I don't understand exactly, because there'll be the dead resurrected. It's difficult to understand many opinions about exactly what the details will be. The Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt, the Mashiach will be here, the generations will be resurrected, those that will be. It will be a physical existence. But it will be a physical existence with only happiness and peace. It says that there will be no death in the world, there will be no wars, the political dispensation in the world will only be Torah. I'm not going to go into more detail than that. That's what it will be. After that, there will be a transcendence into the 8,000 year. You follow the 8,000 years, which is called the Elef HaShmini, which the Rambam holds. And again, there are different opinions, and all of them are true. But I'm just going to give you one model for now. I don't mislead you into thinking it's as simple as this, but a workable model that you can hold in your mind is this. The 8,000 years are transcendence into a non-physical plane. It means that you follow, all the neshamas in the world will leave this particular plane of existence. They will move to an existence where there isn't any physical being at all. There is still what's called a kli. A kli means a vessel. There's some kind of vessel, but it's a transcendent vessel. And inside the vessel is a light, which is more transcendent than the vessel is. We can go into a lot more detail about these things, but that's what it is. The 9,000 years is a transcendence again, and they are exponential in their relationship to each other. The 9th transcends into a 10,000 years, that's called Elef HaAsiri, and according to the basic opinion, according to the Rambam, what will happen then is that that is a unification again with the original source dimension that was before the creation. There's a lot to say about that also, right? Will the neshamas still be left enjoying themselves as neshamas, or will it be part of Hashem's oneness? I'm not going to go into it, but basically it's a unity of the original dimension. There are Rishonim who hold that then there'll be another 10,000 year cycle after that, and we're actually in the third or fourth of those 10,000 year cycles, and the neshamas in the next 10,000 years will relate to us as humans now, as people do to fish. That means they will be so much greater and more illuminated as neshamas, you follow? As humans are to fish, so will be the proportion. Rabbeinu Bechaya goes into this. There will be 50,000 of those, and it makes up many millions of years. Okay, and I'll give you a reference in English also if you want to see that. But the basic, I don't have to go into that, the basic understanding that we can have as a model, okay, is this, that at that level, we, from the 8,000 years on, okay, we can call Olam Haba, which is a non-physical existence. Okay? In that phase, it doesn't say anywhere that there are reincarnations. There's no world to come back to. There's no physical finite world to come back to. Somewhere between now and then is a phase where all the neshamas get judged. It happens every day, as we said before. It happens every night. It happens all the time. There's a judgment that happens at death. And there's a final Yom HaDin that no one's experienced yet, where everything gets settled. All scores get settled. Now, punishment and suffering and what we've discussed up to now go in stages until that final stage. Some neshamas need more
painful experiences in the next world to correct things that they lived through or did over here, and others need less. The worst that can happen, the worst that can happen to a neshama, is what the Rambam calls koros, which means what he explains in the explicit writings as being non-existent in the next world at all, completely. The Rambam says, lo elam, lo elam, forever and ever and ever. But the Mekubalim in Kabbalah, in Kabbalistic writings, it says, I'm trying to, for the people to get worried, in the Kabbalistic writings it says that forever, there's no such thing in Hebrew. The word lo elam means for the world, which means that the longest a person could ever go into that phase is while the world is the way it is. But after that, every neshama gets back where it was supposed to be, because obviously no part of the world can be dropped. No part of a complete unity can ever disappear. The only thing that will disappear is the illusion. But the reality will never disappear. And every human neshama, certainly, actually it says every grain of dust, will be represented over there. Because nothing that Hashem makes is accidental. So everything that He makes will reveal itself as what it was supposed to be in the end. In other words, we only have free choice about how you're going to get there. You follow? We don't have free choice about what you'll be in the end. There's no free choice at all. In the end, all that will be revealed is Hashem's intense oneness, which is what He started with in the first place. But the only thing is, you're given a gift of the opportunity to decide how you're going to contribute to that. Are you going to get there through screams that they're going to draw out of you, or through the happiness of choosing it yourself, right? Although it involves difficulty. The worst that could happen is to do so wrong and so bad and so destroy your own physical, your own spiritual being, that a person would have to go into that dimension of whatever that suffering means for as long as the world is in this phase. But when it's... Are you with me? Now, reincarnation, that's a very, rapid, racing overview of the scheme of things according to a simple model. Reincarnation, we understand, is during this phase. During this phase, which means that when a person dies in this world, the neshama enters a phase that the Ramchal calls Olam HaNeshamos. That is not the final revelation, right? But it's certainly not this physical existence. He says that spiritualists, people who involve themselves in contacting people who are no longer here, okay, who do that terrible sin that they're not allowed to do, causes intense pain to those neshamas, as I've mentioned often before. What they do is they bring people back who are in that plane. That plane is called Olam HaNeshamos. The Ramchal says it has some of the happiness and revelation of the next dimension, but not all of it. It's an intermediate plane where the neshama coasts along or floats along, but he still has enough of his outer clothing, what they call the levushim, the outer sort of garments of the neshama. It's not a body, but it is an outer garment that is tangible enough that somebody who knows how to get in touch with it can draw it down. That's how they get in touch with the neshamas. In fact, in some Kabbalistic writings it asks, how can they get in touch with the neshama that is so on such a transcendent plane and bring it down here? The answer is they don't. They get in touch only with the levushim. By the way, when a person is called back to this world by people who know how to do these things, which they shouldn't be doing, I repeat again, what happens is the neshama doesn't come down, only the outer levushim. Only the most outermost garment of the neshama that it's left with comes down. A long discussion. Anyway, be that as it may, they can bring that down to the world. These neshamas that are in that halfway sort of plane, right, waiting for the final dispensation, those neshamas sometimes have to come down again. You follow? It's got nothing to do with the final thing. Why do they come down again? It's not a concept of punishment. The concept is something like the fact that the neshama, you'll find in Eastern writings and thinking, you'll find exactly the same idea. We know that Eastern thought has its root in the Kabbalistic wisdom, right? We know that clearly. It says quite clearly in Kabbalistic sources exactly how it developed. Many of the mantras are fragments of Hashem's Hebrew name, as you probably know. We won't go into that now. The point is that you'll find the same idea as an explicit development of this Kabbalistic idea, that sometimes the neshama has been in the world, it didn't experience what it needed to experience in the overall scheme of things. Sometimes due to its own error and fault, and sometimes due to the fact that it couldn't remain around long enough in the world to undergo what's called the tikkun, which means the sort of correction, if you like, that it needed, because the grand overall scheme didn't allow that. That means there were other considerations that need that neshama to be removed from this world before it had gone through that experience. So what's happened is it gets sent down again to go through certain experiences that then do whatever's needed to be done, and not always as a human, which you see immediately means it's not a question of coming down again with free will. There's a Gemara about an animal. There's a clear Gemara that Marshall says is talking about a calf. The Gemara says quite clearly that Rebbe was once walking in the marketplace, and a calf was on its way to be slaughtered, and when it saw him, this calf, as an animal often does, had a premonition, a sense of what was going on. It sensed a great spiritual power, and it ran up to him and it put its muzzle under his coat, seeking comfort or refuge. So Rebbe said to the calf, go, because that's what you were created for. He knew the calf was going to be slaughtered, and he told it that. And it says, because he spoke those cruel words to that animal, he suffered for 13 years. He suffered the most horrendous sufferings in this world, as I think I mentioned to you, until one day, just for completeness sake, I'll tell you, he was in his home when his housekeeper or maid was about to sweep out a nest of rodents, mice or something, and he said, don't do that, that's their home, and his suffering stopped. He followed when he did an act, the opposite, I mean, talking about somebody at that level. The point is that the Marshal says, what's this business about a cow that ran up to Rebbe in the market and he told it to go and be slaughtered, he's speaking to animals, what's going on? It was a reincarnation of a human neshama that needed that experience. And Rebbe wasn't being callous. He was telling it exactly what it needed. Other of it was comfort. It was comfort. He was saying, don't be afraid. Go to this experience because that's what you were brought to the world for. It's a beautiful idea. You were brought to the world for this. That's what's going to help you. But nevertheless, because it sounded cruel and it had that touch and twinge to it, he suffered for 13 years. Huh. People at that level are judged at that level of exactitude. That's the idea. Does that help a little bit? Most of us, it says, are here for the third or fourth time also. Okay?
But you mean that the world is after the Messianic I mean, you mean that the world ends?
The physical world ends. After the 8,000 years, the physical world will end.
Yes. Planet.
Yes, the planet. That's it for the planet, yes. Okay, well, good. Continue next week.